Hi folks, welcome to episode 3 of the Watcher podcast. It's almost December and we had some gremlins interfere with our recording this week. So here's one we recorded recently that we've been really excited for you to hear. We're going to talk today about... What are we going to talk about, Richard?
Been thinking a little bit today about how the right co-opted language and the political right, the political American right, co-opted language and turned the way we think about our politics and policy towards themselves to the point of it's almost impossible to have a discussion coming from the other side in a valid nature.
So the reason we're going to talk about that and the reason we're going to talk about all of these things is I am an outsider and I'm interested in America. I'm some guy from Ireland and I had the good fortune to meet Richard, who is from America and who is very well educated about the political climate in America. I asked him to explain things to me occasionally and discovered it was so interesting that it might be kind of cool to record it. So this is what you're going to hear.
Yeah, good luck for you.
So, educate me.
Go ahead. Okay, so today there was an incident in my last couple of days. There was an incident in my life where I had used the term nation state, and that's a term I learned when I was a kid. You know, it came right after city states, and in college did some, had teachers use it, and professors use it rather, and it's a valid term, and I had used this term, and it angered a friend of mine because that term. Nation state is something that a guy like Steve Bannon likes to use a lot. And it dawned on me that my friend had keyed me into something that I hadn't thought of, which was that Bannon had almost co-opted that term for himself. And Steve Bannon, being generally a negative person from what I've read and seen, can turn that into a pejorative, you know? Merely by him using it over and over again and associating himself with him. And it made me think of something that really bothered me personally about the political language in America today stemming from 9/11. When 9/11 happened in America, it was a huge shock. And, you know, nothing like this had ever happened to us, like that had ever happened to us before. And we weren't ready, but you're never ready, so that's kind of a stupid thing to say, I guess, but it was a shock, and there was a lot of hand-wringing, you know, how this happened, what do we do about it, and there was a lot of hand-wringing, and there was a lot of America, of patriotism, of Americans gathering together as a country, which is, unfortunately, I think one of the last times we've really done that. And over time, as the political and policy implications of 9/11 became clear, one party, the Republicans, who had generally been associated with national security over the course of the last probably 50 years before 9/11, they started co-opting it as like a not just a I mean it was already a party message. But they started co-opting things like patriotism, like the very concept of patriotism itself. And I think that some of it stemmed from George W. Bush saying, if you're not with us, you're against us. And I say that because I heard people on the street say that to me. You know, at the time that this happened, I lived in Yakima, Washington. And it's a decent little town. I mean, it's a country town, kind of. You know, I mean, it's not very large, but it's out in the country. And I would say, generally speaking, most of the people there, and it might have changed, but at the time I lived there, were Republicans. And when the drum up to the Iraq War came, there was the question of, well, there wasn't a question. The Republicans started drumming a question into people that if you weren't for the Iraq War, you weren't a patriot. And everybody had to wear the stupid little lapel pins and you had to just basically parrot President Bush or you weren't a patriot. And I also think that Fox had a huge influence on that. This was when Fox really, really, really started to hit its stride was during the Bush administration and cemented what it was going to become, which is what it is today. It's just hate and fear. But at the time, I think that they saw that too, that patriotism was could be used as a cudgel rather than as a concept of how one feels about its nation, about their nation rather, not its nation, their nation. It became a political cudgel. If you don't agree with me, you're not a patriot. And I didn't, I really wasn't well read enough at the time in politics to know the history behind the right doing that. But if there's a long history of it. I think of how many people are shocked when I say, pro-death is the opposite of pro-life. And then it just baffles me. How can you be shocked by that? I mean, your mind unconsciously thinks that when you hear pro-life, your mind unconsciously thinks the other side must be pro-death. Or at the very least, they're not for life. And then you have terms like the Democrat Party, not that you catch people in the mainstream news, like the decent mainstream news, not Fox. I can't even, that's not even news, but you catch people in the decent mainstream news saying the Democrat Party, maybe not the anchors that are on there all the time. They're careful to use the appropriate term for the party that they want to call themselves because that's what a journalist does. But when they have pundits on, and it's not always, a member of Congress. They do it with Republican members of Congress without fail, say the Democrat Party, because Gingrich and oh, the hammer, Tom DeLay, just beat it into them that that was the language you must use, And the right, they keep doing this. It's even economic. Like, it didn't used to be we measured our nation by its wealth, but now we do. Because the right did that, They wanted to, they have done such an excellent job of controlling the narrative that we use amongst each other that we are having a hard time breaking from it. And I don't even want to say that, I mean, that some of it is us. Like, and I wanted to start with this, but I'm kind of scatterbrained about it all of a sudden. Like the term racist, that term, it's an Enlightenment term, race, it's an Enlightenment term, and it's a ridiculous term. You'll find that as we continue to do these, I really try hard not to use that term. The term itself separates us by assuming that we humans are of a different race. Does that make sense? And if the term continues to be used, then the idea seed is still there. And I think of it like if aliens were to drop out of the sky tomorrow, they wouldn't say blacks or whites or Russians or Americans. They would say humans. I mean, they just would. Like, they would look at us as, biological beings that are on one planet, and we would have that name. And when we separate ourselves with the language, we let that language beat us, I think. I know that's hard to.
That makes perfect sense to me. Like, unfortunately, even using the word racist accepts this bigoted idea that there are separate races. And it's like we're saying, oh, it's bad to judge the different races, but there definitely are different races, when in
Right, yeah,
fact there
exactly.
aren't. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a self-assured narrative that, oh, I'm not a racist. Well, you kind of are because you just said you were, You don't know you did, but you did. And if you bring that to today, I also want to say that both parties have engaged in this. In the 90s, it's really funny, actually. One of the things that struck me the most when Donald Trump started running was that he immediately said he was tired of political correctness. And I thought to myself, I haven't heard that term in wide use in America since the 90s. Now, I'm not going to get into why that was Donald Trump's basically heyday, and he seems to always harken back to the 90s, his obsession with the Clintons and all that, Something bad. He must have gone through some sort of trauma or something in the 90s. But I think that's when he had his sixth bankruptcy, so maybe that's it.
Yeah, it's always the sixth one is the hardest one I've heard.
I don't know, they say that first one, you never really get over it,
Yeah, the first cut of the
But
onions, baby.
Oh, nice. Good reference. So, but I mean, like, in at the time, and I didn't like it then, and I wasn't even really into politics then, but it just had a, it's always left a bad taste in my mouth that we say African Americans or Mexican Americans or anything like that, because that's not what America's about. Now, I understand that you want to, that a person could want to have their heritage proudly amongst them as an identity. I get that. All right. I'm proud to be Scottish, and I ain't even never been to Scotland, you know? I get that. But I don't call myself a Scottish American. And why is that? Because if you come here and you agree with our ideals, you're an American, right?
You don't have to call yourself a Scottish American because you are not othered by mainstream American society.
Exactly. Oh, wait, you're counterpointing it. Oh, I get you. See,
No,
that's a good point.
but I'm agreeing
No,
with
but
you.
that's a good point.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but in a way, but that's a good point too. Like, it's possible that the terms were brought out. Like, I don't know who started the term African American. I don't know who started that. It could have been for very well the most altruistic reasons that one could think of. But it's come to a point now where that term only serves to separate us and subset us, you know? Like, I don't, I would rather just say somebody was black. And not any reason because it's a descriptor. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, as an Irish person, I was bewildered when I first went to America, and I was hearing the term African American all the time, and I was talking to this dude, and then somebody was like, "Oh, yeah, that guy, the African American guy," and I was like, "Well, yeah, no, the black guy," and they were like, "No, the African American guy," and I was like, "Yeah, he's Dominican, by the way."
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know, who's to say you're from Africa, you
Yeah.
know?
So it's a weird, it's like a weird thing. Yeah, I think a lot of the use of the word comes from a good place, but I don't know. And I also, it's just not for me to say, basically. That's the big one.
Yeah, no, oh, I totally agree with that. I mean, there's really only so much I can know, and I can't take the other side of that. I really can't, you know.
Yeah.
But I can say that it feels to me like when we label ourselves as something other than just American, then we subset ourselves. And yeah, we're a huge country and there's all kinds of different cultures in this country. And I get that, and that's cool. That's part of the melting pot. And I want all those cultures there because eventually they all, you know, influence each other and become better along the way. But I don't think that, I think that no matter what the term was at the beginning, it has become something that was not what it was originally intended to be. And I feel like, because I don't know if you lived here at the time, but a lot of that was around the time where people, Democrats mostly, were saying that's not politically correct about certain things that Republicans would say, you know? And really, when they said that's not politically correct at the time, what they meant was, this is racist. You shouldn't be saying that, you know? Or that's a bigoted statement. You shouldn't be saying that. But they were trying to be politically correct about it and say that's not politically correct. So then flash forward to now, and you have an entire nation of people who were told that they were being politically incorrect rather than actually just racist assholes, you know? I think that that would be a product of how the conversation has shifted so far rightward that it became, if you're a bigot, you're politically incorrect. You're not a bigot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a genius move that political correctness is treated as this like artificial construct that's imposed upon us. When in reality, political correctness is like a set of agreed rules for behaving moderately decently.
Morality, ethics, you know,
In a
like
very basic sense.
yeah, absolutely, yeah, no, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think that because of that, and I'm not even sure that the right did that, oh, that one particularly on purpose. Like, I think that it's almost something Donald Trump tapped into. Like, I'm not real sure. That's really weird. The people on the right, they have this long, like the writers and I'm talking about guys like David French and David Frum and guys like, two Davids, check that out. Guys like that, you know, they've been in a place where no matter what the people on the left told them, they felt like they were doing, they would just say, oh, you're screaming racist, racist, racist. I don't have to listen to you. Mm-hmm. And it shifted the conversation from dog whistles to bullhorns, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I wonder how some guys that I read years ago and still today feel, they have to feel justified in that they were saying in, you know, the 90s, hey, look, dude, that is a bullhorn. That is a racist dog whistle. And you can't be saying that. It's dangerous. And, you know, they just poo-pooed them on the right because they were controlling the language on the right. And that's how they controlled it, dude. They just said, oh, well, you silly liberals, you know, you always scream the same word, so we're going to find other words for it.
That's pretty cool.
And it's, yeah, well, it really is, you know. And yeah. I think that for some of the people on the right, like Gingrich, it has been a concerted effort to shift the language towards them. Like, why is Social Security called an entitlement?
Right.
And something you're entitled to, generally, most people generally associate something one is an entitlement as something they did not earn. And I'll use an example. I have a friend who was on food stamps recently, right? And that friend said that he was embarrassed to go to the store to use them. Mm-hmm. He's like, well, I don't want people to know I'm on food stamps. And I said, why? And he said, because it's embarrassing. I said, why? You paid for them. I mean, you've been working your whole life. Yeah. Why would you be embarrassed to take what? I mean, you're not, you are entitled to it because you paid for it. You know, you're not getting back as a fraction of what you spent from that, quite honest. But in America, the language is, thanks to Reagan, they're all just, you know, deadbeats. As soon as you need a public program, you're a deadbeat. So that language shifted, you know? And they, again, moved that communication sphere a little bit closer to the hate. Right?
Yeah, it's dizzying. I mean, I don't know what it's like on the inside. On the outside, I'm just every day, I'm shocked at how far it's gotten, and every day it slides further.
Well, you know, if you and I, well, I'll use myself as an example because I'm the one living in America, but if I was of a different skin color, this would be something that I would be experiencing rather than observing.
Right.
You know, and that really is one of the things that's bothered me the most is that I watched, and please, I'm not trying to, I actually watched an episode of Pod Save America, okay? And I thought it was okay. It was all right. There were smart people on there, good panelists. But it was yet another talk show in which people that are more steeped in a subject are assuming that everyone that's listening knows the minutiae of what they've learned over the last 30, 40 years. Does that make sense?
I want to hear more about that because I think that's a big part of what we're talking about in a broader sense, you and I, and this whole show.
I think you're right too. As a matter of fact, when I shared it with someone said to me, you know what I liked the most about it was that you weren't assuming that I knew things that I didn't know. Mm-hmm. So that when you spoke about it, I felt like you were talking to me on a level that was, you know, letting me understand why you were saying what you were saying.
Yeah, that's huge. You know, have you ever heard the description of the news? I'd love to know who coined this because it's amazing. But somebody once described the news as tuning in to a soap opera that's been running for hundreds of years, and you're on episode 10,981 and you have no recap.
That's pretty perfect.
And
yeah, it really is. Yeah.
I think that's really, really good. But I think like a part of what you and I are doing here is it's like, well, yes, you're sitting down on the couch and you're going to watch that episode. But fortunately, you have a friend with you who can go, oh, okay, well, this guy here, in a previous episode, he was the guy who was actually doing the other thing. And
yeah,
that's really helpful.
I think that it's funny. Have you ever listened to a Rush Limbaugh show?
No.
I actually would encourage you to do so.
I can't. I absolutely see the value in what you're saying, and please go on, but I can't. But go on.
Well, okay, full disclosure, I did, like, you know, 20 years ago, because I was with the person who liked to listen to it, and I didn't, but no, it was maybe 15 years ago. I hated it, but the one thing I noticed about Rush is that he's really good at connecting the dots for people. And I'm not saying the dots that he connects necessarily should be connected, or that he's connecting them for altruistic reasons, because I do think that Rush is a profit guy first and foremost. But he is good at that. He's good. Like, one of the reasons he can wrap people up in it is because he tells a narrative and he doesn't assume you know everything. So if he starts telling a story about something and he wants to emphasize it, he'll say, because, you know, X congressperson made this vote at this time, and then he'll go on, you know, he'll put it into context for you like that. The news doesn't do that. You just get, well, I mean, they got to squeeze so, you know, I would love to say, well, they have to squeeze so much into half an hour, but it's 24 hours a day. They can take the time, but yeah, they go in these hour blocks where they refuse to take time. Speaking of Rush, do you know how Rush Limbaugh's show got to so many places being aired, to so many stations?
No.
It's like the most ridiculous story ever. It's one of my favorite stories of politics. It's really simple, but it's one of my favorite stories. Oftentimes, when there's a show, at the time that Rush was doing this, when there was a show that was new, what would happen was is the producers of the show, the monetary producers, you know, executive producers, I guess, they would put out, they would give the show for free to little radio stations who sometimes have trouble filling airtime. Uh-huh. all around the country, and that the advertising came with it. The advertising dollars came with it.
Okay.
Like, so we have this show that I guarantee you X Gold Company is going to put 10 minutes of commercial time on this, and you can fill all the rest of it. We don't want anything else. We just want you to run this one commercial three times.
Okay.
And so they give them the show. Well, they gave it to all these little tiny radio stations all over America when, you know, right around just after the Fairness Doctrine went away. And suddenly every trucker and salesman and farmer is listening to Rush Limbaugh because it's free programming for their local station. Not because they agree with it, because it's profit.
Because it's there.
Yeah, because it's there. That's right.
Shit.
And so Rush starts brainwashing America, and that's how he got so big, because they gave him away.
That is so wonderful and stupid and awful.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, that guy does not owe his success to any sort of talent, really, because they gave it away to so many stations. By the time he started actually making money, he already had a listener base. Because they didn't have a choice. I mean, that guy was on for 4 hours a day, you know?
That's insane.
Right in the middle of the day. When you're driving your truck or out in your field or sitting in your, you know, your shop, twisting your wrenches, you know, turning your wrenches. There's old Rush talking to you again. Your company for the day.
That's terrible.
Isn't it really, too? And, you know, the weird thing is when you think about it, I've kind of just named the Republican base.
Mm. Yeah.
They owe him a lot. They really do. They're such a corrupt party. And look, I know this isn't about, well, you know what? It is kind of tied back to the communication. They're so corrupt. John Boehner. You know what John Boehner is?
Yes.
Okay. That man was Speaker of the House, okay? Now, I want you to realize that years before he became Speaker of the House, he actually walked around the House floor handing out $20,000 checks for votes for his brother's tobacco company.
Insane.
Yeah. So let's just make him Speaker of the House. I mean, he knows how it works, obviously, right?
Right.
And think about that, because that's true. That's true. He knew how to play the game, so they made him the speaker. That's the only reason he became the speaker, is because he knew how to play the game. And he knew that game was about handing out checks on the floor. Why bother with the middleman, right?
At some point, I'd like us to talk about what your opinion is. It doesn't have to be today's episode, but what your opinion is about how the open corruption of the Republican Party is allowed to slide. Like how, what's the inertia, what's the public inertia that allows that corruption to happen not behind closed doors, but in the open?
Well, that's the, because they that's actually, it's funny you should say that. That was one of the things to me that them grabbing the language of politics enabled them to do.
Okay.
Like, there was corruption in the Reagan years, plenty of it,
Sure.
plenty of it, and in that administration, and it was still just folksy old Ronnie, all the while he's literally ignoring people dying from AIDS, calling everyone that's on welfare deadbeats. The old hand up argument, pull your by your bootstraps, And I think that they, as a party, have been using a fixation on the other to couch their, and I mean when I say nefarious behavior, for 60 years, Why someone would keep voting for them, I don't know. I once told a guy at a job, I wrote it in a tweet. I told a guy at a job about how many, I mean, I did a thread and I just listed the Republicans that had been, either not reelected or kicked out of office or actually brought up on charges for corruption or scandal. In since Nixon, and there were hundreds of them, right? And I told the guy about it, who I knew was a Republican in a gentle way. And you know what his response was to me? That's why you get people like Maxine Waters and Nancy Pelosi.
What?
Really, when you,
What does that mean?
well, exactly. Well, does it mean he wasn't listening? Does it mean he refuses to hear it? Does he mean that he hears what he wants to hear?
But what is
Does
he
it mean
even
all?
saying?
Well, he's saying what Fox News tells him to say.
Like,
He's saying
what's
what
his
Matt Gaetz
point?
tells him to say, and what Paul Ryan tells him to say, and what Mitch McConnell tells him to say. And they've had a united front of language that has been the a twisting of reality for so long that they have already created an alternate reality for their voters. And I posit that they've twisted language in their favor for so long that they've created an alternate reality for all of us. Like, why are they still even called conservatives? The last three admins, four, let's see, Reagan raised taxes and spent a bunch of money in the government and made the government bigger. That's the opposite of conservatism. George H.W. Bush did the same thing, the opposite of conservatism. George W. Bush, he created the largest government agency mankind has ever known in the Department of Homeland Security. That's not conservative. Now he'd lower taxes, but we went into debt. The economy crashed. Now we have another president who is lowering taxes, but they're not conservative. He wants to, opioids and all the, they want to spend a bunch of money on stuff, but that's not conservative. Conservative is smaller, more concise government. And a guy like David French, who I used to consider a real conservative, I'm using that name because I saw something from him today that kind of got me. Who I used to consider a small government conservative that I read because of that, because I wanted to know what they wanted and why they wanted it. And if there were anything in there I could use to make me smarter, And I can't even read that guy anymore because he never writes about that. He only writes about social issues. They all now write about social issues. The culture wars, culture wars. And that, to me, is one of the biggest lies of the Republican language grab, is that they used to say all the time that Democrats in the 90s, when social, when I'm sorry, when politically correct became something, when African American became something, And I don't, please, I don't, I'm not trying to harp on that term, just that's an example, representative example of the times, you know, that they started saying that the Democrats were all about culture wars, that it was all about, you know, the culture, and they wanted to change culture, and they wanted it to be different than what they want, what the conservatives wanted, when in reality, the conservatives have been trying to change culture to their view of what a Christian culture should be for decades by then. But they successfully turned that around. Like the mob with McConnell. Just brilliant. When he said it, it terrified me and amazed me at the same time because it was fucking brilliant to say it. Terrible. I mean, it's terrible. It's dangerous. And it may mark one of the moments of when comedy was lost in this country, but it was brilliant. He took what was a rightful protest from people who were rightfully angry, and they were redressing their government according to the First Amendment. And he called them a mob, and it worked because the media parroted it. They take the language. They move the Overton window yet again, you know? And that's what they do. They pick like pulling a thread off a sweater. How long have we been at this? I feel like we've gone long.
Well, yeah, we're just over 30 minutes.
Oh, that's probably perfect.
Yeah, this just before we go, this concept of culture war, I think it's an amazing piece of branding, because if rock and roll musicians said that dance music was an act of war, just because it made people buy less rock records, people would be like, "What are you talking about?"
Right.
Like,
Yeah.
what?
Right.
Like, they're declaring war on you? What are you talking about? It's just people's tastes change. That's what happens. But people moving forward and having new opinions is culture wars, and that's an amazing, evil piece of branding.
Well, it is too, and you know what? I have to say this before we go then, because that is actually one of the biggest thefts of language that has been engaged by all people in Washington is that the American political tendency to call anything you want to change a war against it. The drug wars, right?
Yeah.
There was branding wars in the 60s, in the 70s, you know? Everything, or we, you know, the drug czar or the
Sure.
bank czar, you know? In America, that's what we do. We're the most warlike nation since Sparta, maybe ever, actually. I would probably go with ever. And so everything's a war. So why not a culture war, right? Why not a war? More branding.
Why not a war? Let's end on that point.
Yeah. Okay, well, hey man, always a good time, of course. Thanks for doing it with me.
Yeah, man. Always a pleasure. Let's do this
Let's hear
again
the
soon.
spook. Yeah, man, let's hear that spooky music.
All right. Good night, folks.
Good night, man.